The Infrastructure Show is brought to you by Wyss Janney Elsner Associates, engineers, architects, and materials scientists, solving complex problems in contemporary and historic structures since 1956. Learn more at wje.com.
Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University.
And I'm your co-host, Tom Herman.
The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it.
The United States General Service Administration's Public Service Division, in its role as a landlord for the government, has in recent years been on the leading edge of green building design, new and retrofit construction, operations, and maintenance. Among GSA's initiatives is to, quote, act as a green proving ground, end quote. And many of its facilities it manages have become showcases for energy efficiency and new technology.
Here to discuss the green building achievements of GSA is Dorothy Robine, who's Commissioner of the Public Building Service. Dorothy, thanks so much for talking with us today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the mission of the Public Building Service? What kinds of buildings do you manage? How many buildings? What's the scale and scope?
The Public Building Service is really the real estate arm of the federal government, affectionately referred to as the federal government's landlord. We design, build, repair, maintain buildings for federal agencies. We oversee about 400 million square feet of space altogether. We have about a little over a million federal workers in that space. About half of it consists of buildings that we lease, so commercial buildings where we lease from a commercial lessor, and then about half of the space, about 200 million square feet, is buildings that we own. The monumental federal buildings in Washington, D.C., federal courthouses, land ports of entry, and a variety of other buildings. It does not include military installations, VA hospitals, and a highly specialized space, but pretty much everything else.
How's the PBS funded? Do government tenants pay rent for the space that they use?
Yes, we're a very business-like operation. We charge our federal tenants a commercial equivalent rent. If it's in leased space, it's of course we're passing on the charge from the commercial lessor. If it's in buildings that we own, it is the commercial equivalent rent. And the rationale for that is that it gives federal agencies an incentive to conserve in their use of space. They pay us rent that goes into something called the Federal Building Fund. It's a quasi-revolving loan fund.
So that's a little bit different, as I understand it, from other funds flowing into other agencies. That is my understanding when I deal with people, for example, in Department of Transportation, is that money coming in goes back to general revenues, doesn't come back to the agency. But you've got a separate set-aside fund to maintain the buildings?
Well, in theory, yes. The money comes into the Federal Building Fund. I said it was a quasi-revolving loan fund because it has to be appropriated every year by the Congress. And for 40 years, Congress has pretty much appropriated all of the money that comes into the Federal Building Fund to us to maintain our existing buildings and to lease buildings and then to build the occasional new building. The last 3 years, Congress has not done that. They've diverted between $1 billion and $1.5 billion of the funding in the Federal Building Fund into non-GSA activities. And so we have not had a capital program in 3 years, meaning no new construction and no major repair and alteration. That's been a major problem, major challenge for us.
That sounds like it's squeezing the infrastructure, the quantity and quality.
Yes, it is. It's been a major problem. Now, we did get a sizable amount of money through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or the stimulus funding, ARRA, American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. GSA got about $5.5 billion for investment in our in our buildings with a heavy focus on sustainability and energy efficiency. So because of that, we have been able to get by, but we are in a very precarious situation.
When did the Green Building Initiative start and how?
GSA has been interested in energy efficiency and sustainable buildings, I would say going back to probably the first big energy crisis in the Carter administration. Of course, I wasn't around then, but I've heard it goes back to that. And I think even before then, we put a green roof on Housing and Urban Development headquarters building in downtown Washington in the late 60s. But I think in the early 70s, we began to make energy efficiency part of the mission. Of course, funding has always been a challenge, and we have an inventory of buildings that's fairly old. We don't have any single program. We have a series of programs that are designed to make our buildings more energy efficient. We have a set of standards so that when we do design or do major renovation, In meeting those standards, we make our buildings very energy efficient. We are making heavy use of energy savings performance contracts. This is a contract with private companies, say a Honeywell or a Johnson Controls or a Siemens, where they invest the upfront cost of improving energy efficiency, and then they're paid through the savings in our utility bill. We have a green proving ground program, a kind of beta testbed program for innovative technologies and practices that we think have wide application. Fairly recently, we've undertaken a smart buildings program, which is focused on our most energy-consuming buildings and is designed to take the information we already get from advanced meters and combine that with information from building automation systems in order to get minute-to-minute data on the performance of these buildings and fine-tune them. So we have a variety of programs that help us achieve greater energy efficiency.
And in terms of retrofits, what are some specific innovations that are of interest to you? Any examples? One coming to mind is the Edith Green Wendell Wyatt Federal Building in Portland.
Yeah, well, that's one of my favorites. I went to the ribbon cutting on that. I think we did a lot of great work with the ARRA funding. I think Edith Green Wendell Wyatt may be our iconic ARRA project. It's a 1974 standard federal office building downtown Portland, Oregon, designed by Skidmore, Owens, and Merrill. Precast concrete facade. It looks like federal office buildings of that era. And GSA began looking at doing a major renovation of that building, in part to make it more energy efficient. I think as early as 2003, 2004, but they didn't have the funding. By the time the ARRA funding came along in 2009, the federal government's energy requirements had gotten considerably more ambitious and demanding, and so they had to actually go back and rethink the design. They did two fundamental things, and I'm not an engineer, but here's my take on what they did. They got rid of the precast concrete facade and got it down to and replaced that with a glass curtain wall. And that allowed them to push out the perimeter of the building by a foot on every floor. It gave them an additional foot of space, which totaled about an additional floor of space on an 18-story building. And removing that weight, this is not all about energy efficiency, allowed them to reduce what they had to do to make the building more seismically adequate as well, because they got rid of a lot of the weight of the building. Then they went to radiant heating and cooling. So they replaced an air-based heating and cooling system with radiant heating and cooling, so water. And the water, by the way, comes off the roof. It is stored in a 165,000-gallon storage tank in the basement, which used to be a rifle range used by the Federal Protective Service. The radiant heating and cooling system, it's little coils flat against the ceiling. That allowed them to get rid of ductwork and raise the ceiling by a foot. And in order to accommodate that system, they design the facade of the building to reduce solar heat gain. The trade-off for going to radiant heating and cooling was to reduce the solar heat gain by half. So on the west-facing facade of the building, they incorporated fins, which are aesthetically beautiful, and which reduce the solar heat gain by about 50%. Now, the combination of all that is the additional, they freed up all the mechanicals on the penthouse floor. So they now have, by going to radiant heating and cooling, they now have 9,000 square feet of rentable space on the penthouse level with a view of Mount Rainier and Mount Hood. And then overall, two additional floors of rentable space. Energy consumption is down by something like 55% compared to what it was. Water consumption down dramatically. It's a gorgeous building. It works beautifully. The tenants love it. It was a remarkable experience for the architects and the contractors as well.
Now, this may be a philosophical question, but when you describe all the changes that were made from a concrete facade to a glass facade, the floors being extended, the ceilings raised, going to radiant heat, the new mechanicals, at what point do you go from a retrofit to a new building?
Yeah, that's a good question. This was very much a retrofit. I mean, it is the same building. There were certain limitations. They couldn't go to natural ventilation because of they really had to work with what they had, and they had a sizable budget, about $140 million, but they couldn't do everything. There's another building that I'd like to talk about, and it's in the same region. It's south of Seattle. Federal Center South. It's a building that we built for the Army Corps of Engineers on the Duwamish River, and we took an existing warehouse and we rebuilt it. It is technically considered renovation, but it's such a radical change that I think it counts as new construction. And that was remarkable in different ways. There, it's a much smaller building, just a couple of stories high. It's on the banks of the Duwamish waterway. And because of the nature of the soil, they had to sink pilings 400 feet deep into the ground. And so they took advantage of that and put pipes for geothermal heat into the pilings. It's not the first time that's been done. It's the first time in that region. And then they added a phase change thermal storage tank, which makes that process even more efficient. So most of the heating and cooling of the building is done with geothermal heating system in the actual pilings for the building. One of the techniques, both at Edith Green Wendell Wyatt and at Federal Center South, the Army Corps building, was to, and it really all of our renovations, has been to start by reducing the load as much as possible. And where possible, we work with the tenants to do that, you know, by different IT technology. I mean, a major thing we try to do, of course, is daylighting, but also going to low partitions. We really push this notion of collaborative workspace, getting away from individual offices and high partitions. Low partitions takes advantage of natural daylight, better air circulation. So you can significantly reduce the load on the building before you undertake other things. And that's a major, major part of the process.
I want to take you back to this description you gave us about collaborating with private sector companies, particularly the Siemens and Johnson Controls and organizations like that. It sounds like this is a kind of model of privatization where, if I understand correctly, they have an incentive to deliver energy savings because that's where their compensation comes from. Is that a fair description?
Yeah. Are you familiar with the energy savings performance contract concept?
No, you should tell us about that.
Yeah. It's something that I believe the private sector uses as well as government, but it is performance-based, and the federal government has, we call them the Sweet 16. There are 16 of these large, they tend to be very large companies that have been selected through a competitive process. And then on each individual project, then one of the 16 is selected again competitively. And they go into a building, identify what they think can be done to make the building more energy efficient. And it takes quite a while. It takes a very long time, as much as a year and a half, to actually negotiate a contract. They have to be very sure about what they're doing because they're guaranteeing you certain amount of savings, and they get that savings only if the utility bill is lower. It's a wonderful process. I'm not 100% satisfied with it, and one of the pet peeves that I have with it is that you have some of these very, very innovative companies like Honeywell and Siemens, and because they're trying to minimize their risk on these sorts of projects, they're not incorporating technology that is maybe as forward-leaning as we would like it to be. So these companies in their own labs are coming up with wonderful technology. It is not what they're using, though, in their role as an ESCO, as an energy savings company. But that's a fairly minor complaint about a wonderful program. The federal government has the president challenged federal agencies to do $2 billion worth of energy savings performance contracts by the end of 2013. We're responsible for about $200 million of that, or $175 million.
In terms of new construction, are you getting close to the magic number zero energy?
We're not doing a lot of new construction, largely for budget reasons. About $1 billion of our ARRA funding went into new construction. We've built a number of new courthouses in recent years, but by and large, our money goes into maintaining, improving our existing buildings. And you mentioned net zero. We have one ARRA project with a historic building, which will be net zero, and this will be the first example of a building on the National Register of Historic Places that will be net zero, and it's the Wayne Aspinall Courthouse and Federal Office Building in Grand Junction, Colorado. It's not yet net zero. We think it'll take us about a year of operation to get to that point, but we think we'll reach it, and we'll do that through a combination. First of all, we worked with the tenants to substantially reduce what the demand would be for energy in the building. We're able to put PV on the roof, set back so that it's not visible from the street, and then again make use of geothermal technology.
This is a very layman's understanding, so it may be incorrect, but would a net zero building mean that it could be basically unplugged, not connected to the grid, and just stand there on its own and generate its own energy?
Not in this case. A net zero building just means that you're generating as much energy as you're using. But I think what you're talking about, a building that can go off the grid, requires additional technology. I spent 3 years at the Defense Department overseeing military installations before I came to GSA a year ago. We had put a lot of emphasis there on developing the technology for microgrids and storage that would allow us to, if we needed to island, meaning to go off of the grid. We weren't looking to go off the grid just for the heck of it, but if the grid were to go down, we wanted to be in a position that an installation could continue to maintain key functions. We don't worry about that with GSA buildings. We typically have backup generators for power, but we're not focused on trying to go off the grid.
Sure, and I was thinking that more just a way to conceptualize it, not that there would ever be a need to actually not be connected.
It is a good way to conceptualize it. I am not a strong proponent of the concept of net zero. My background is in economics, and I think a net zero is a very arbitrary number. Why zero? Why not minus 20? Why not plus 20? You know, I think the level of energy efficiency that you achieve in a building should be based on the costs of doing so, and that the additional cost to get to net zero can be extremely high in some buildings. I mean, realistically, it means can we use renewable energy? And we're not as well positioned in our buildings as the Defense Department is, where they have an installation with a lot of land. So it's much more of a challenge for us.
Your buildings are more likely to be located in cities. So in your management strategy, are you guided in any way by established standards or checklists like the LEED certification or the Work of the Green Building Initiative?
Yes. Well, first of all, one of our things that we have been steadily achieved is the goal under federal legislation for federal agencies to reduce their energy intensity, which is equivalent to energy consumption, by 3% a year relative to a 2003 baseline. And the goal is 30% by 2015. And we're actually a year ahead of schedule. So GSA has been hitting that target consistently. I was not able to do that when I was at the Defense Department. We were chronically behind schedule, but GSA is actually ahead of schedule. So we have reduced our energy consumption by about 24% relative to 2003, and we're on track to hit 30%. So that's an important target. Now, you mentioned LEED, and we do use, for all new construction, major renovation, we do strive to achieve LEED Gold. Other federal agencies use other third-party certification standards, for example, the Green Building Initiative's Green Globes, but we, GSA, have consistently used the LEED standard.
And in terms of the mission to be a green proving ground, do you get the sense that private sector companies are watching what you do and thinking about using some of the technologies that you might try that they might not be ready to, like elevators that generate electricity on the way down?
I like to think so. And this was a major focus of mine when I was at the Defense Department. Here at GSA, we have a program called the Green Proving Ground. At DOD, we had a program called the Installation Energy Testbed or Facility Energy Testbed. It was run by our environmental R&D organization, and the programs are similar. The DOD program was considerably bigger than the Green Proving Ground and somewhat more risk-taking. DOD has a very deep culture of test and evaluation. I think the programs were appropriate to the two agencies, but I was and remain a passionate believer in the role that the federal government can play as a testbed for next generation energy technologies. There are a variety of impediments to commercialization and widespread adoption of next generation energy technologies, and particularly in the area of building energy efficiency. One of the major impediments is the high cost to the first user of a technology. If you're the first one to use it, you bear additional costs and you get no additional return. And so it's hard for companies with new technologies to get those technologies to market. So we, DOD, and here in the Green Proving Ground, we try to help overcome those barriers by testing technologies. And I'll give you my favorite example to illustrate this is it's a technology that we've incorporated into the renovation of our GSA headquarters here and just a block from the White House, electrochromic glass. I'm sure you're familiar with this. It's the self-tinting glass. It's like dark glasses that get darker when you go out in the sun and then lighten up when you come inside. Electrochromic glass has, and it's there's two manufacturers, Solidigm and Sage. It has a lot of potential to reduce energy use, and the big payoff comes because you can, in theory, if you incorporate electrochromic glass into your building, you can go with a smaller chiller, a smaller HVAC system. But it's typically the architect of a new building or a renovated building that makes the decision about how big that chiller needs to be, and they're understandably hesitant to sign up for a smaller chiller with the faith that this electrochromic glass will reduce the need for the traditional size chiller. So getting data, getting very, very solid data on the performance of this technology is absolutely critical to getting architects and engineers to accept it and to incorporate that into the decision they make about the size of a chiller.
That is certainly an interesting perspective, the notion that the work that you're doing is not only market leading, but also very much driven by metrics that provide a foundation for future planning and decision making. Dorothy, you've really educated us on this subject. I very much appreciate your spending the time with us for this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much.